This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about cloud in calendar weeks 23 and 24. Frenis has built a sovereign cloud market radar for ICT providers with weekly hot news, monthly reports, quarterly leadership presentations, and AI podcasts for field teams. You can find more info in the description. Welcome to the deep dive. So I want you to imagine for a second that it's 2026. You're a CIO, you're sitting at your desk looking at your financial projections, and you suddenly realize something completely counterintuitive.
Let me guess. Moving cutting-edge AI workloads back to an on-premise mainframe is actually cheaper than running them in the public cloud.
Exactly. Yes, mainframes. Which, I mean, it sounds completely absurd.
Well, it sounds totally absurd if you look at it through the lens of, like, the last decade.
Yeah.
But that is exactly the reality we are barreling toward right now.
Yeah.
Because the public cloud originally promised us infinite scale, zero hardware maintenance, pennies on the dollar for compute power. But right now, we are seeing this massive structural pullback.
It's wild. Everyone suddenly seems to be scrambling to buy physical servers again, you know, repatriate their workloads and lock their data inside these highly specific, geographically isolated vaults.
Right. And if you're an ICT or tech professional listening to this, you're probably feeling the whiplash.
Oh, absolutely. So today, we're going to unpack why this is happening. We've spent the last couple of weeks analyzing the most critical shifts dominating the top cloud trends on LinkedIn for calendar weeks 23 and 24, and there's a very clear mystery here.
The cloud was supposed to eat the world.
Yeah, exactly. So why is cloud first suddenly being replaced by what David A. recently called a cloud selective strategy?
Well, it's because the questions that tech leaders are asking have fundamentally changed. As David pointed out, the boardroom conversation is no longer about if an organization should move to the cloud.
Yeah.
They're now looking at their entire portfolio and asking which specific workloads actually belong in a public multi-tenant environment, which ones will perform better on bare metal, and crucially, which ones absolutely require sovereign, heavily localized architectures.
Yeah, let's pull on that thread of sovereign architectures, because that feels like the biggest immediate driver pulling workloads out of the public sphere right now. And I mean, this isn't just about companies getting nervous about their intellectual property.
No, not at all.
It's being forced by massive regulatory shifts, especially over in Europe.
It is entirely regulatory driven. If you look at the analyses shared by Kees Hoogervoorst and Martin Zwick recently, they broke down the EU's tech sovereignty package and the upcoming Cloud and AI Development Act.
Right, Kadir. Yeah.
Exactly, Kennedy. What's fascinating here is how the legal definition of cloud infrastructure has completely transformed. Regulators, they aren't treating the cloud as just an IT service anymore. They're treating it as critical national infrastructure.
Yeah.
It's being put on the exact same regulatory tier as the national energy grid or like the telecommunications network.
And as Ilias Chances pointed out, this means the old playbook is just dead. Because, you know, a few years ago, you could satisfy regulators just by proving your data physically resided in a data center in Frankfurt or Paris.
Right. Data residency was enough.
Exactly. But Chances noted that buyers are now legally mandated to demand absolute jurisdictional and operational control. Okay, let's unpack this, because this is where I get a bit confused.
Right.
If a European government essentially says, we don't trust US or Chinese cloud providers anymore, we are only going to use local ones, aren't we just swapping a massive, highly efficient foreign monopoly for a smaller, less efficient domestic one? I mean, how does creating a walled garden actually help an enterprise scale?
Well, that is the exact trap that policymakers are trying to avoid. And Ovi Young brought up a really crucial point regarding public sector procurement here. True digital sovereignty isn't just about looking at the passport of the company's CEO. If you lock yourself into a local vendor and can never leave, you aren't sovereign. You're just a hostage to a different master. So Young argues that true sovereignty requires contestability.
Meaning the power to realistically fire your supplier.
Exactly. That and deep interoperability.
Which brings up that incredible historical analogy that David Eves shared in this context. It completely changed how I look at this problem.
Oh, the NATO interoperability crisis.
Yes. So back in the 1950s, NATO realized they had this massive problem. They were a unified alliance on paper, but every member country used different rifle calibers, different aviation fuel grades, entirely different communication protocols.
Total nightmare for logistics.
Right. If French troops ran out of ammo, British troops couldn't hand them their magazines. Now, NATO didn't solve this by forcing every country to buy their weapons from one single American manufacturer. They solved it by establishing incredibly strict standardized protocols.
And Eves argues, we have to do the exact same thing with the cloud today. If you enforce strict architectural and API standards, digital sovereignty can coexist with operational flexibility.
You don't need one giant provider. You need a highly standardized ecosystem.
Exactly.
But wait, hold on. Let me push back on this a bit, because the U.S. hyperscalers are not just giving up on Europe. I was reading Guido Hockenberg's breakdown of the four levels of sovereignty under Kanaan. And Amazon recently announced they are dropping 7.8 billion euros to build a dedicated European sovereign cloud.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
7.8 billion. Are you telling me that kind of money still doesn't buy them full sovereignty status in the eyes of the EU? How does that hardware sitting on European soil not count?
This is where the geopolitical legal clash happens, and Hockenberg laid this out perfectly. Level one sovereignty just means the data physically sits in the EU.
Okay, so Amazon clears that easily.
They clear it easily.
Yeah.
But level three sovereignty, which is going to be required for highly sensitive workloads, that mandates that the cloud provider must be owned and legally controlled from within Europe.
Ah, I see.
Amazon cannot touch level three, regardless of how many billions they spend in Germany or France. Why? Because they are headquartered in Seattle, which means the U.S. Cloud Act still applies to the parent company.
Meaning U.S. federal authorities could theoretically subpoena that European data, and Amazon would be legally bound by U.S. law to hand it over, which directly violates European law.
Exactly. The physical location of the server doesn't matter if the corporate entity holding the keys is subject to a foreign jurisdiction. And Paula Fokan pointed out the massive market implications of this legal paradox.
Right.
Right now, U.S. hyperscalers hold roughly 65% of the European cloud market. When CAT is fully enacted, it is going to retroactively turn that 65% market dominance into a profound compliance nightmare for any enterprise running critical infrastructure.
Wow. And we are already seeing enterprises executing on this reality. Like, it's not just theory anymore. Dr. Ferry Abulhassan shared a breakdown of Volkswagen's new dual cloud strategy.
Yeah, that was a great example.
For their standard applications, sure, they use the public cloud. But for highly critical, sensitive workloads, they are physically separating those systems and deploying T-Cloud private to ensure absolute resilience and legal sovereignty.
And we're seeing it on the channel partner side, too. Janet Smith and Michael Schulte highlighted that Capgemini just became SAP's first sovereign cloud partner across several European countries.
Right.
This is serious capital expenditure moving away from traditional public clouds and into specialized sovereign architectures.
But, you know, regulations and compliance are really only half the story here. Because even if you're operating a company outside of Europe, completely untouched by CADA, there is another gravitational force pulling workloads out of the public cloud.
The AI economics.
Yes. The sheer jaw-dropping cost of running artificial intelligence.
It is completely breaking the traditional economics of the cloud. The numbers coming out right now are just staggering. Anand Kalyan and Nagesh Jaiswal shared a major statistic from Broadcom's Private Cloud Outlook 2026 report.
Oh, yeah, I saw this.
Listen to this shift. Private cloud has officially overtaken public cloud for production AI inferencing. Right now, 56% of enterprises are opting for private on-premise deployments for their AI models, while public cloud usage for inference has dropped to 41%.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because repatriating AI to a private cloud sounds like a fantastic way to save money on paper. But to me, it sounds like buying a high-performance sports car because you want to save money on your Uber fares, but suddenly realizing you now have to pave your own roads, refine your own high-octane gasoline, and hire a full-time pit crew.
That is a brilliant way to put it.
I mean, are enterprise IT teams actually ready for that massive operational burden?
You've hit on the multi-million dollar catch right there. Mm. And Anand Kalyan validated exactly that concern. When you pull a massive workload out of the public cloud and get home, operational load moves home with it. For the last 10 years, the public cloud abstracted away all the truly miserable parts of IT. The thermal cooling, the hardware load balancing, the 3 a.m. incident response. Paving your own roads demands a level of operation maturity that a lot of infrastructure teams simply haven't maintained.
But the token costs of AI are so high, they are basically being forced to do it anyway, right? John Schultz pointed out that the unpredictable infrastructure spikes associated with large-scale AI have simply broken the public cloud pricing model for these companies.
Exactly. And Rami Alkhafaji highlighted some incredible IBM data that puts this into perspective. 72% of organizations are facing higher than expected cloud costs right now.
72%?
Yeah. The financial pressure is so intense that executives are actually rating mainframes, literally legacy iron, as better than the cloud on a cost per transaction basis for specific AI workloads.
See, that just blows my mind. Mainframes. We're talking about technology that peaked in the 1980s. How does a mainframe beat a hyperscale cloud cluster for cutting-edge AI?
It comes down to data gravity. If you are a massive bank, your core systems of record every transaction, every account balance run on a mainframe. If you want an AI to analyze that data in real time, moving petabytes of data back and forth over a network to a public cloud for inference is astronomically expensive.
Not to mention the latency.
Right, the latency makes real-time analysis impossible. The AI has to run where the data physically lives.
Moses Acosta framed this perfectly. He said AI is forcing a hard reset on cloud strategy. It is no longer about simply being cloud first. It is about establishing a strict economic control model. And we're seeing the big tech vendors acknowledge this reality and adapt their software to it. Douglas Phillips was talking about the recent Microsoft Build conference where they showcased Foundry Local.
Which is a massive paradigm shift.
Right. Foundry Local allows agentic AI autonomous AI agents that can make decisions and take actions to run fully on-premise. Zero data movement outside the enterprise environment.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just about software agents reading spreadsheets. Alex Romero brought up the rise of physical AI, which completely redefines where infrastructure needs to sit.
Oh, like robotics.
Exactly. We are seeing the convergence of AI, cloud architecture, and robotics. Think about an advanced manufacturing floor. The machines in that factory aren't just standalone hydraulic tools anymore. They are cloud-connected, intelligent agents. They perceive their environment, they reason through production problems, and they act.
And you can't run a robotic arm relying on a public cloud server three states away. The round-trip latency alone would cause the machine to crash into a wall before the server even processed the stop command.
Exactly. The compute demands for continuous, real-time physical parsing require the infrastructure to sit inside the factory, on the edge. So between sovereign data laws, the sheer cost of API tokens, and the latency demands of physical AI, the public cloud is no longer the default destination for everything.
So if AI is breaking the bank and forcing this massive repatriation effort, that brings up a really scary question for CIOs. For the workloads that do stay in the cloud or operate across these incredibly complex hybrid environments, how on earth are companies controlling the spend? Because your engineers are suddenly making massive financial decisions every time they execute a script.
Which brings us to our third major theme, the rapid forced evolution of FinOps. Financial operations in the cloud used to be a highly reactive task. As Ajay Joshi pointed out, it was essentially a finance team looking at a dashboard at the end of the month, gasping at the AWS bill, and then yelling at engineering to turn off some idle servers.
Yeah, but that doesn't work when an AI agent can spin up 10,000 concurrent processes in 3 seconds. Azilarasan Natarajan shared a wild statistic. 98% of FinOps teams right now are tasked with managing AI spend, but almost none of them have the granular tooling required to actually govern token economics effectively.
Because treating AI spend like traditional cloud compute spend is a recipe for bankruptcy. Traditional compute is billed by the hour or the second. AI is billed by the token.
Every single word.
Every single word, every snippet of code read or generated costs money. The optimization can't happen at the end of the month. It has to happen at the engineering level the moment the code is written.
Bruno Capuano shared some highly practical advice on this, specifically regarding developer tools like GitHub Copilot. If you give Copilot access to your entire enterprise code base, like a massive context window, you are paying for millions of tokens every single time a developer asks it to fix a simple typo.
Which adds up incredibly fast.
Yeah. Capuano noted that using AI tools more doesn't have to mean burning more money. You cut the token drama by training your engineers to use much smaller context windows, deliberately selecting cheaper, smaller models for simple tasks, and using agent mode with incredibly strict financial guardrails.
And we're seeing FinOps move directly into the integrated development environment, the IDE. Banerjee mentioned the new AWS FinOps agent, which is currently in preview.
Oh, right.
This tool brings cost anomaly investigations straight into the daily workflows of the engineers. You don't have to wait for finance to flag an issue. The engineer gets a real-time prompt suggesting an architectural optimization right there on their screen. It is shifting financial accountability all the way left.
And speaking of those architectural optimizations, Lefteris Karageorgiou shared a brilliantly simple engineering hack on LinkedIn that I absolutely loved. He needed to build a serverless read API, and he built it in 10 minutes. But he completely skipped the compute layer.
Wait, really?
Yeah. He didn't use an AWS Lambda function at all. He just used native integrations to connect API Gateway directly to DynamoDB.
Which is brilliant from a cost perspective.
Exactly. Because AWS Lambda has cold starts, it takes time to spin up the compute environment, and you pay for every millisecond it runs. By bypassing it entirely, Lefteris eliminated the spin-up latency and cut out an entire billing layer. As he put it, sometimes deleting a layer is the optimization.
And there are dozens of these micro-optimizations emerging at the platform level, too. Victor Garcia listed several major cost-saving updates that dropped right around the FinOpsX conference. For example, Google Cloud's BigQuery just introduced fluid scaling with per-second billing, meaning you aren't paying for heavy compute cycles the second your data query finishes.
He also mentioned Azure's global PTU reservations. For you listening, a provisioned throughput unit, or PTU, is basically a guaranteed reservation for AI compute power. But traditionally, if you reserved that power in a specific region, say US East, and your demand shifted to Europe, you just wasted all that money. Now, Azure is making those reservations region agnostic, letting companies shift their compute allowance globally to chase demand and eliminate wasted spend.
All of these tactics raise a critical question about how we view our relationship with the hyperscalers. George K. Matthew made a very sharp point. Cloud commitment maturity isn't about letting your procurement team chase the highest discount percentage on a 3-year contract. It's about balancing technical efficiency with financial flexibility based on your actual business reality.
Right.
And Guy Bartram added a crucial layer to this. Cloud portability is fundamentally an architectural decision, not a contractual one.
Meaning the cloud providers don't lock you in with lawyers, you lock yourself in with lazy engineering.
Exactly. The hyperscalers recently made it free to transfer your data out. But if your application relies on 50 proprietary AWS or Azure services that don't exist anywhere else, your architecture is what keeps you trapped.
Yeah.
And let's not forget the macroeconomic reality here. The hyperscalers are currently investing roughly $600 billion in AI capital expenditure. Someone has to repay that $600 billion, and they fully intend for it to be you.
So what does this all mean? We're obsessing over exactly where our data lives, like renting a highly secure titanium vault in a specific European city. But with all these APIs and interconnected systems, are we just leaving the vault door wide open?
That is the ultimate paradox of this entire industry shift, and Tim Raines articulated it perfectly. He argued that data residency is very often just security theater.
Security theater, meaning it looks good on an audit report, but doesn't actually stop a breach.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It satisfies regulators and creates a feeling of comfort for the board, but it completely ignores the reality of how threat actors operate today. Attackers do not care about the physical geography of a server. They don't care if your hardware is sitting in Frankfurt, Dublin, or an Ohio cornfield. They care about connectivity.
Because they aren't physically breaking into the data center, they are attacking across networks using compromised credentials and open APIs.
Right. Phishing, credential stuffing, API exploitation. As Raines points out, every time you deploy a new AI system, it calls external APIs, it exposes internal APIs, and it radically expands your attack surface. Putting your data in a sovereign data center solves a political problem and a legal problem. It does absolutely nothing to solve your security problem. The real architectural challenge, and the actual security work that protects the business, is rigorous identity management, strict network segmentation, and flawless API governance. If you don't have those fundamentals dialed in, your multi-million-dollar sovereign cloud is just a locally hosted data breach waiting to happen.
That is a deeply sobering thought, but absolutely vital for any architect or engineer designing these systems right now. You cannot just check the compliance box, wipe your hands, and assume the engineering is secure because the server has a European passport.
Exactly. And as we wrap up this deep dive into the insights from the past couple of weeks, this raises an important question, drawing on the perspectives of Enrico Signoretti and Lars Neumann. They pointed out that the industry is effectively dividing IT leaders into two distinct camps right now.
Oh, the cowardly versus courageous CIOs.
Yes, there is the cowardly CIO. This is the leader who looks at the overwhelming complexity of new regulations, the sprawl of AI, and uses it as an excuse to avoid making hard architectural decisions. They treat vendor lock-in as just a necessary technical trade-off and cross their fingers hoping prices don't spike.
All right.
And then there is the courageous CIO. This leader treats stack lock-in not as an IT problem, but as a massive systemic risk to the survival of the business. They design the exit strategy before the kill switch is flipped.
They engineer the portability first.
Yes, because while achieving true digital sovereignty, managing AI token costs and securing a sprawling hybrid architecture might require intense engineering and come at a premium price. The question you have to ask yourself is this: what is the true long-term cost of not being sovereign? What is the ultimate cost of outsourcing your fundamental business continuity to a foreign tech stack that you cannot control?
If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on ICT and tech, digital products and services, artificial intelligence, sustainability and green ICT, defense tech, and health. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the forces reshaping the cloud. We hope this gave you a clearer lens to view your own infrastructure strategy. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an update on where the tech industry is heading next. We'll see you next time.